Welcome to episode 308 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us. I am your host, Ian Martin, and today we're going to be high up in the mountains in Europe as I share my recent ski touring adventure in Chamonix. That trip included staying in an unmanned refuge at 3,000 metres, and we're going to take a closer look at some of the most spectacular alpine refuges in the world. As well as that, we're crossing the Atlantic to find out about the ski resort synonymous with Robert Redford, Sundance, in Utah. And if that's not enough for you, we also have news of a post-Olympic spike in visitors to the UK snow centres, plus our regular snow reports, your feedback, and well, that's today's bumper show. Before we meet today's guests, I'd like to thank Tyrol, Austria, for sponsoring the Ski Podcast. This winter, we've covered some fantastic destinations in the Tyrol. They include some you will definitely have heard of, like Kitzbühel, Meierhofen, and St. Anton, and some that might have slipped past your radar, such as Tyrol West, Surfaus, or St. Johann. I've genuinely enjoyed finding out more about all of them, and you can too, as all those episodes are available now in our back catalogue to catch up with. Now, let's move on to today's show and meet my guests. Regular listeners will recognise the voice of my first guest. I calculated this is her fifth appearance on the show, I think, last of which was in episode 242, when she reported on Saint-Gervais, a resort I will be skiing in about an hour's time if things go well. I'm delighted to welcome back freelance journalist Katia Gaskell. Hi, Katia. How are you?
Hi, Ian. I'm very well, thank you. Nice to be back again.
Oh, and whereabouts are you today?
I'm in London. I've been away quite a lot this season, which has been great. But finally back home.
Oh, excellent. And my second guest today joins us for the first time. He is an adventurer and photographer based in the Alps and has a new book out featuring some of the most spectacular alpine refuges in the world. He is also founder of the magnificently named British Adventure Collective. I'm delighted to welcome Aaron Rolfe to the Ski Podcast. Hi, Aaron. How are you?
Hi, Ian. Yeah, good. Thanks for having us on the podcast.
Oh, and whereabouts are you today?
So I'm in Italy, and I split my time these days between sort of the northern Italy region around Lake Maggiore and Chamonix.
I think you said to me in the green room, you're somewhere near Lake Maggiore, is that right?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, so it's like sort of the pre-Alps, rolling hills and plenty of lakes. So it's good for mountain biking and trail running and stuff like that as well.
Oh, cool. Sounds fantastic. I am currently based in Chamonix, as regular listeners will know. I've kind of decamped over here for a couple of months. And currently, if I turn my head, it's snowing quite heavily. I'm here at 1,000 metres in Chamonix. We've got about 20 centimetres of snow on the balcony, which is pretty exciting, going down to Saint-Gervais later. As listeners will hear later on, I was recently out in the backcountry earlier this week. But a question I do like to ask my guests is when you skied or snowboarded last. And Katia, when would that be for you?
So I just got back about a week ago from Colorado. So I did a little road trip exploring some of the small independent resorts there. Started in Winter Park, which is not that small, but then went to Loveland and Cooper and Monarch. And it was amazing. It was a really, really great trip.
Oh, nice. I have to ask you, it hasn't been a great season for snow in Colorado. How was it when you were there?
Look, it wasn't the best, but it was better than it had been. So, everything was open and still got lots of skiing in. Well, actually, it snowed the day we arrived, so we had some good snow in Winter Park. Considering the winter they've had, it was pretty good.
Okay, I'm really pleased to hear that. We're going to be hearing more about another trip that you did to the States a little bit later on. But Aaron, for yourself, when were you last on snow?
Just 2 days ago. I was ski touring in the sort of Mont Blanc Massif, Dom de Miage. Don't know if you know the peak. It's a nice big sort of 3,600 meter peak, long tour because you start in Contamine near the valley. But it's a beautiful, nice route to do.
Fantastic. We were in slightly different bits of the mountains. We're also in the backcountry as well. From 3,600 meters, how was the snow at the top there? I guess, were you going for the exercise, the mountaineering, or the actual snow itself?
Yeah, we were actually producing a little film documentary with a friend, Dave Searle. So it's all about the sort of best ski lines of Europe. And we're just slowly plugging away at that. So it's sort of considered a classic. So we thought we had to cover it. But it's a really nice sort of varied adventure. It's a long tour and you do it as a full loop. And the snow, yeah, on the glacier at the top was super nice, actually. I had to be a little bit careful of some wind-blown areas, a little bit loaded. But no, generally very good snow. And then obviously when you do a descent of 2,000 meters, you end up with some pretty questionable snow at the bottom, but it's all part of the experience. And a little walk as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we'll have to have you back on the show when you've completed that movie. Snow has been falling down across the Alps. We've got some of our regular contributors have sent in their snow reports. Claire Harrison reports from Medissimo in Italy. Mike Richards was in Gausta last week in Norway. And Alex Armand from Tip Top Ski Coaching is in Leyde's Alps. So let's have a listen to them.
Hello, Ian and Ski Podcast listeners. This is Claire Harrison with Select School Skiing, reporting in from Little Madesimo up in the Lombardy Alps of northern Italy, right on the border with Switzerland. This is a ski area called the Val Chiavenna. This is normally quite a snowy little corner of the Alps. It catches the snow from all directions, both storms coming from the north and those that come up from the Mediterranean to the south. And at the moment, they've got a pretty good base on the mountain, up to 120 centimetres up on the summit, and still cold enough for there to be some snow down in the town. On top of that, they've had a little refresh of the pistes in the last week before we arrived, and the forecast is for a little more to snow to come, possibly tonight, but in the next 2 or 3 days. If it does come, it really will refresh the pistes very nicely, and the colder temperatures we're expecting should help it to hold for the run up to Easter. And this being Italy, of course, they've kept the pistes in absolutely lovely condition. So we're looking forward to a couple of weeks of really good early spring skiing leading up to Easter with all our school guests. So wherever you're skiing, ski safely, everyone. All the best. This is Claire Harrison with Select School Skiing in Madesimo. Ciao.
Good evening, Ian. It's Mike the Snow Richards reporting in from Gausta. I'm sure many of your listeners will be thinking, where? Never heard of it. Well, they're missing out because my partner Neris and I are just back from a truly amazing experience at this gem of a resort in the Telemark region of Norway, around 3 hours west of Oslo, thanks to Crystal Ski Holidays and Norway Home of Skiing. It was snowing when we arrived on Sunday and continued into the following afternoon before the storm broke. We enjoyed ankle-deep powder on piste and amongst the comfortably spaced trees for the first 2 days, and then immaculately groomed pistes and bluebird skies for the rest of the week. Whilst the 400 metres vertical and 35 kilometres of slopes is small compared with the resorts in the Alps, the lack of skiers on the slopes, no queuing, and the quality of the snow and grooming means you can rack up significant mileage each day using a combination of surface lifts and chair lifts to crisscross the mountain very easily. It's the perfect beginner and intermediate resort with a logical and excellent progression of difficulty, along with a couple of challenging blacks for those who feel the need for speed. There's extensive above tree line off-piste terrain when the conditions allow, but the pièce de résistance is the series of off-piste itineraries from the summit of neighbouring Gausta Toppen, the 1,883-metre standalone peak which looms over the resort. What makes this day extraordinary is the lift to the summit is a two-stage train which travels inside the mountain. It's a former Cold War observatory, which is now a gateway to spectacular views and 700-metre descents to challenge even the most experienced freeriders. In good conditions and led by a guide, you could even drop to the town of Ryukan for a 1,500-metre descent. Ryukan was a site of a pivotal episode in World War II where Norwegian resistance forces sabotaged the heavy water plant the Nazis were using to develop atomic weapons. Their exploits were immortalized in the movie The Heroes of Telemark, starring Kirk Douglas. Douglas's stunt double in the movie was local Olav Svartdal, with his few reputedly paying for the development of the Gausta Blikkfjell Resort Hotel and the resort. So if you're looking for a very different ski experience with great hospitality, amazing cuisine, a very friendly welcome, and bucket loads of history and culture, then put Gausta on your wish list. Until next time, this is Mike the Snow Richards, hoping your listeners have a snowy Easter.
Right, just moving on to a little bit of news. Firstly, I wanted to remind listeners that theoretically, the new entry-exit system, EES, with the EU will scale up to 100% on the 10th of April. So that means you should probably allow a little bit more time to get through customs. And by EES, that means getting your biometrics, your fingerprints and facial photo done. Secondly, I'm delighted to report that Freddie Carrick-Smith picked up silver in the slalom at the Junior World Championships. Well done, Freddie. We've also seen World Cup wins since the Winter Olympics for Kirsty Muir in Teen and Mia Brooks in Flachau in Austria. And talking of the Olympics, earlier this week, I spoke to Ian Brown, a managing director of the Snow Centre, about the post-Olympics jump in traffic that he's seen in both Hemel Hempstead and Manchester. Right, I'm delighted to be joined by Ian Brown today. I guess, you know, most of our listeners are in the UK, and you have two snow centres in the UK, so the Snow Centre South at Hemel Hempstead and the renamed Snow Centre North. It used to be called Chill Factory up in Manchester. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show today, Ian, was because you were saying to me that the visitation in the snow centres, both North and South, you've seen a significant increase since the Winter Olympics.
Yeah, there's just been an amazing response this time around. I mean, every 4 years we've had an element of uplift or excitement on the back of the Winter Olympics, but this one has been off the scale. So, you know, our usage and visits February, March have been 20% up on previous years. And to put that into context, these are our busiest months of the year anyway. So to add another 20%, we have been full to the rafters.
Right, and it's not just in the snow centres themselves. Traffic to the website has gone up quite a lot as well.
Yeah, we track all this kind of data and information, and we've seen a 44% increase in traffic to the website. And what's really interesting about it is 42% of the visits have been first-time visits. So it's not just been about people who can already ski and snowboard. It's definitely inspired people who've never thought about it before to come and have a look and come and give it a go.
Yeah, I mean, that is really encouraging. I think so many people really enjoyed watching the freestyle events, you know, listening to Tim and Ed doing their commentary and getting excited about watching Kirsty Muir and Zoe Atkin and Mia Brooks. Just in respect of that, I mean, I know that I've had listeners contact me, younger listeners, who said that, you know, their goal is now to go to the Olympics. I would guess that most of our listeners are perhaps a bit older and have children. If they wanted to kind of go to the snow centres to try some of those features, such as the slope style features, maybe rails or kickers or boxes, etc., are there certain times they have to go to be able to do that?
Yeah, each week we run sessions in both sites. It's not available every day, but, you know, take Hemel, for example. Thursday nights is our freestyle evening there where we have parks out. And in Manchester, it tends to be a Thursday and a Friday as well. And after Easter, we're setting up a number of Give It A Go events. So if people want to come and have a go at race training because they've seen it, or moguls, or they want to come and do some freestyle, we've set up some sessions which are already starting to get bookings on the back of people being inspired from the Winter Olympics.
Oh, and you actually told me earlier that some of those Give It A Go sessions, some of the promotions you've brought forward, they would have been offered maybe a little bit later in the year. Is that right?
As I said, you know, January, February is our busiest time of the year anyway, and it's when everybody's getting ready for their holidays, so our lesson programs tend to be full. And then as we move towards summer, it's a bit quieter. We introduce lesson packs, so you can buy a set of lessons for a special price and then take your time to learn when the slopes are quieter. And we brought those products forward, such as the demand and interest in having a go at skiing and snowboarding and wanting to learn. So we've already seen a big uptake by bringing those forward now.
So say someone wants to go along, you know, we're coming up to the Easter holidays and someone wants to go along to the snow centre. Would you say there's a better time of day to be going along to either Manchester or Hemel?
Easter holidays are coming. All the kids will be off. So we have school programmes and junior programmes running during the week. Thereafter, the summer is a quieter time. Weekends still remain quite busy, and I guess that's when most people are off work and the days become a bit quieter. It's definitely the best time to learn. It's the best value for lessons. And more so than that, in terms of the slopes not being so busy, you can learn at your own pace. You can take your time. If you've not got a holiday booked within 1 week or 2 weeks, you can learn over the summer and then get ready for your holiday next year and be in better shape for that, you know?
Oh, well, that's brilliant, Ian. You know, I hope those numbers continue to go up and are up year on year. And also that we start to nurture the new generation of Olympians for maybe not in the next cycle, but the one after that, perhaps, or something like that. That's brilliant, Ian. Thanks for sharing that with us today.
You're welcome.
So, as I mentioned earlier, I'm living in Chamonix for the next couple of months. It's one of my favourite places, and later this spring, I'm going to be releasing a special episode all about this incredible destination. Now, while there's some great lift serve skiing here, one of the things I was most excited about was exploring some of the incredible high mountain terrain. So, on Monday, my brother and I met up with mountain guide Brad Carlson in Argentière, for a couple of days of what you could call backcountry skiing. It was more like, for me, ski mountaineering 101. We did 1,800 meters of climbing on skins, but there was some scrambling across a rock, roped up with crampons on, followed by rappelling down a couloir with the help of an ice axe. That was a pretty stunning day. I chatted to Brad at the end of that day for a reminder of what we'd achieved. By the way, apologies for the background noise in this. That buzzing is my brother going in and out of the refuge. So let's have a listen to my chat with Brad.
Wow. So we're at the Bivouac de Doré, about 3,000 metres, 2,980 maybe,
yep.
With Brad Carson, our guide for today. Thank you so much, Brad. I mean, that was amazing. Lots of things I've never done before. I wondered if maybe we could just kind of like recap the day, because we started in Grandmonte, Argentière. We went up the main lift, then we went up Beauchard.
Yep.
We skied a little bit, skinned a little bit, and then went ski down to the Glacier d'Argentière, that's right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Now, that's where the work really started, yeah, right?
We went up over the Col de la Chasse and skied down onto the Argentière Glacier and then put skins on. And that's where, as you say, the adventure really began, going up to the Col du Chardonnay, which is an 800-meter climb with some steep switchbacks at the beginning, skinning up. And then with the glacier melting, there's some pretty steep, rocky terrain just below the pass. So we had to put skis on our backpacks, crampons on, get roped up, and climb up to the Col du Chardonnay.
Yeah, I mean, that final bit to the Col there, I'm not really too sure how long it took us, but it was an interesting transition from the top of the touring, yeah, which is a fairly good bit of hard work at 800 metres of climbing. Very steep at the beginning. But yeah, we had our skis on our backpacks, crampons on our boots, and we were roped together, kind of edging our way through some snow, some rocks and gravel to get up to the Col. And then going down from the Col on the other side, that was pretty new for me as well. You just want to like run through what your plan was there and what we did?
Yeah, so the backside of the Col, the Swiss side, is quite steep, like sustained 50 degrees, 45, 50 degrees. So good thing there's an anchor up there, really solid fixed anchor in the granite. And we used that. I basically lowered both you guys, you and your brother Duncan, 50 meters down the slope, one at a time. And then I rappelled, joined you guys, and then found another anchor. And as you guys down climbed to cross the Bergschrund at the base of the slope, I kept you on belay just in case the snow bridge over the Bergschrund broke.
Which
it didn't.
Yeah, that was a relief. Yeah, it was kind of interesting going down there. It kind of reminded me of abseiling back in the day, but like quicker. But with the crampons on, you just got incredible grip, you know, on that slope as you're going down. Eventually, we got our skis back
on.
A nice pitch, if shallow. You know, down to the bottom and then ski toured here to the refuge around 3,000 metres now. And this is an unmanned refuge, you know, relatively unusual, I think. So we just got you just dug out a whole load of snow, filled a couple of buckets, and we're melting them. There's gas here, which is fantastic. And we got a few dry meals to rehydrate.
Yeah.
And then we'll be ready for more of the same tomorrow, right?
Yeah. Let's enjoy it.
Cool. Thanks, Brad.
Long-term listeners might remember Brad's name as I interviewed him back in episode 240, which was a special episode looking at sustainability. And on that occasion, we talked about the impact of global warming on the Mer de Glace. So if you'd like to know more about that, I'll put a link in the show notes. Now, the refuge we stayed at was the Bivouac de l'Envers des Dorés. We're going to cover refuges more later in this episode when I chat with Aaron, but I can tell you this was a stunning spot. And although the refuge can accommodate 12 people, I think it was just us for the night. I took in the view outside just before I went to bed.
It's 8 o'clock. I'm about to go to bed because that's pretty late for refuge life. But I'm just standing outside the refuge. And oh my God, it's just beautiful out here. It's a shame there's a few clouds around because there is like zero light pollution here. And I'm looking at the stars. I'm looking at the moon. And it's just so beautiful and so peaceful. You know, there's no sound. It's just such a magical location.
And the following morning, it was even more beautiful. I literally watched the sunrise over the mountains.
I think it might be anachronistic for an
audio podcast to be relaying the sound of nothing. But that's what we've got here this morning. Just coming out of the refuge. The sun is coming up, lighting up the valley. There's a wind. I can see a few tracks from animals. Presumably been popping around in the night. There's no ski tourers up yet. There's no skiers. It's a whole incredibly dramatic bowl. It's just gorgeous.
So day two was easy with less climbing, although with more boot packing, skis on our backs, again with crampons in some pretty soft snow. And, you know, this is all above 3,000 metres. It's pretty tiring stuff when you live at sea level like I do, particularly when you're carrying not just your shovel and your transceiver, but crampons, ski crampons, ice axe, food for a couple of days, extra layers and water as well. We were also wearing harnesses, and I thought it might be interesting for listeners to know a little bit more about what we had on them and why we might need them.
So we're just getting ready to go out for the day, and you've equipped us with a harness here. Now, I thought it might be interesting for some of the listeners to kind of understand like what we've got on this and why we've got it on there. So I wondered if you could just kind of like talk us through it.
Yeah, so for starters, we always have a harness on when skiing on a glacier. It's just a precaution, a necessary precaution, because there is the risk of falling into a crevasse. We're obviously trying to avoid that, but if someone does go into a crevasse, the harness is absolutely necessary in order to be able to pull them out.
Yeah, and you explained as well the reason for this item is should the worst happen in that kind of situation. So what, do you want to explain what this is and how you'd use it?
Yeah, so on our harness, we have an ice screw, which is a very specialized way of making an anchor in ice. And if someone does go into a crevasse, the thought is you put in this ice screw, you know, just twist it into the ice. And then we also have this handy tether here, which allows you to clip into the ice screw and essentially make yourself safe while waiting for rescue. And then we also have this carabiner that you mentioned, which is just a convenient way of tying into the rope on a glacier. Just a really quick clip in, boom, it's done. You're tied in. So that's kind of our basic ensemble for being on the glacier. And then I've got a whole bunch of other stuff, pulley, a rappel device, some slings, all in kind of a rescue, you know, just in case mindset.
So what was that other thing that you were using when we were going up the rocks? You kind of gripped it between the rocks to kind of create a pivot.
Yeah, so with the glacier receding, as I mentioned, the Col du Chalonnet is becoming steeper and more technical. And so guides are sharing, we're sharing information constantly, amongst ourselves. And I heard from a colleague, hey, it's gotten steeper. You should bring one of these cams, they're called. And it's a way of creating an anchor in the rock. So ice screw, create an anchor in the ice. A cam is this mechanical device that you put into a parallel-sided crack in the rock.
And it has another name as well.
It's also, the French call it a friend. Which is the first brand to make them.
Ah, I see.
It's okay. It's like a Kleenex.
Right, cool. You know,
but the actual name is a cam.
Cool. Well, that's brilliant. Well, thanks for keeping us safe, and hopefully we'll continue not to have to use our ice screws or our tether or anything.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Sounds cool. Brilliant. Thanks.
So, overall, a brilliant trip. And if you listened to our last episode when I ski toured and stayed in refuge in Saint-Foix, well, it was sort of like that, but I suppose you could say that was an intermediate experience and this was the next level up from that. I'm certainly keen to do more of it. Now, normally, I would bring in my female guest first, but if it's okay with you, Katia, I think it makes sense to turn to Aaron now, as I think this segues from my Chamonix experience perfectly. I wondered if I could start, Aaron, by asking a question about the Haute Route, because I noticed that you've done the classic Chamonix to Zermatt trip, and depending on your route, you would almost certainly have crossed over with the terrain that we were on earlier this week. I wondered, you know, when you did that.
A few years ago now, so it was off the back of COVID. I did it, as actually my first ski tour many years ago, I guess 7 years ago, as a big mission with some friends, which is definitely, we were sort of above over our head at the time, but we managed to make it through and learn a lot of lessons along the way. And then, yeah, after COVID, I had sort of always had this dream idea to try to do it in one push from Chamonix to Zermatt without sleeping. So yeah, we set off. I was sort of at my fittest after COVID. and set off at 9 a.m. and then arrived in the following afternoon, I think 30 hours later.
Wow. Well, I knew that you'd done the oat route. I didn't know that you'd done it in one go. That's pretty incredible. I take it you did that with other people, or was that solo?
It was solo, but I did have some help from some friends. A photographer friend joined me for the last sort of third, and then I had another friend who I actually live with in Chamonix now, and she very kindly agreed to supply me with some food and meet me in a few different locations along the way.
Well, that's pretty incredible. That's probably another episode in itself. We're going to be inviting you back for sure. So that is just one of the high mountain adventures that you've completed, and I do want to come back to those. But firstly, I wanted to ask you about your new book. So the full title is Alpine Refuges, The Architecture and Culture of Mountain Shelters. I wonder if I could ask you what prompted you to put together this book.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, like many sort of ski tourists and ski mountaineers, I've spent a lot of time in refuges over the previous years. And I guess actually that my first love of this type of building was in Bothies in Scotland back in the day. I mean, Bothies have a special place in my heart, particularly because the weather can be so savage in Scotland. They really are like a safe haven, you know, when you're suffering and it's brutal in winter on a bikepacking or a ski or a mountaineering mission. There's such a contrast between the, you know, the hostility of how the weather can be and just being able to get inside with the most basic provisions, no phone signal, light a fire and all that. I guess sort of moving to the Alps, you know, years later, then it was an extension of that, and I sort of appreciated these buildings in the same sort of way.
Probably most listeners will be familiar with the idea of a refuge, but just to clarify, with a bothy, you know, in Scotland, they are the most basic possible refuges in effect, aren't they? Do you want to just describe what one might look like?
Yeah, so like historically, they're sort of old cottages that have been left behind that sort of modern infrastructure never reached. So, you know, as the development of electricity and all that, you know, sort of extended across most of Scotland, some of these, you know, small buildings were just sort of left to become derelict. And the Mountain Bothy Association sort of saw an opportunity to, you know, renovate, restore and look after these buildings and then offer them to people to stay. So you don't even pay, which is kind of nice as well. You pay for the Mountain Bothy membership per year, which is very reasonable. And then it's free. But as you say, they're very basic for sure. You usually find one or two sleeping rooms, maybe a small living area. And then you'll find an empty fireplace. So you need to bring your own wood, bring your own sleeping provisions, bring your own food. But they're also, I guess, like refuges, they also vary quite a bit. There is one or two that have electricity. Some of them are more sort of refined than others with sleeping platforms. And some of them are literally just a cold concrete room.
Well, I mean, that actually brings me to my next question, because I think most listeners will have an idea of what we mean by an alpine refuge, but there are many different variations on that. Only in our last episode, Catherine Murphy was telling us about the refugi in the Dolomites that sounded positively luxurious compared to the Spartan nature of a mountain hut. What to your mind is an alpine refuge?
I guess that's part of what appealed so much for the idea of the book, because they're so varied. You know, some of them are really rustic old wooden huts, particularly in Switzerland. Some of them are sort of modern contemporary metal structures that have been heli-dropped that look like they've come from outer space almost. But yeah, I guess they all serve the same purpose, which is either to provide a safe space for people if the weather comes in, or probably more likely a way to sort of facilitate a grander adventure as a way to stop over and break down that journey.
I mean, you referred to some of the amazing designs of some of them. Quite near to where I am now, certainly can't see it today, is a Refuge de Goutte. And that always reminds me of R2-D2. You're talking about, like, you know, modern style buildings. It's pretty incredible. You feature 30 refuges in your book. How did you create that shortlist?
Yeah, so I started with, I guess, a long list of either some that I'd visited previously or come across online and did a year of research before. I guess my longer list was probably 100 refuges. And then gradually, once you sort of break down looking for a geographic spread, so I wanted it to feel like there was most of the Alps covered. And then also I wanted some of the refuges to be bivouacs included in the book. And some of them are obviously traditional manned refuges. So that's probably quite an important difference between the styles. The bivouacs are unmanned, I think, like the one you stayed in, where you bring your own food, generally colder, a bit more serious. And then the manned refuges, you're kind of getting looked after. They're heated. You get food. It's all a bit more civilized. But the trade-off is you get a lot more people in them. So for the bivouac experience, it's much more about the solitude and spending time with either your friends or by yourself in the mountains. The manned refuges, it's much more civilized, but you're also probably surrounded by lots of other people, maybe snoring, probably snoring as well.
Yeah, certainly when we did our Oatroot episode, which I listened to a little while ago, both Tris Kennedy and Katie Bamber, who were on that episode, talked about the snoring and the fact that, you know, if you're in a shared refuge, people are often getting up at, let's say, 4 a.m. or even earlier, depending what their objectives are for that day. And, you know, you refer to it in the subtitle of the book, but many of these buildings are architectural marvels. I mean, they're created at stupidly high altitudes, but sometimes you've got these stunning designs. There's one featured in the book, I think, if my pronunciation is correct, it's the Bivaco Gavasuti.
Gavasuti, but close. Yeah, it's an absolutely beautiful refuge. It's located on the Mont Blanc Massif. It's near the east face of the Grand Jurasse. And it's definitely one of the sort of lesser traveled parts of the Mont Blanc area. And yeah, you've got sort of loads of glacier ice surrounding it in every direction. It's perched quite neatly on this rock band. I think most people go and visit there in summer, but actually in winter, it makes for a really nice ski tour. And the chances of you being there alone is obviously a lot higher in winter. Most people don't brave it.
I mean, I've been to two unmanned refuges now, and I really just love that experience of being up there on your own. But a lot of them evidently are in very inaccessible places. What has been the most difficult one to get to for you when you were putting together the book?
Yeah, there's been a couple. I think Hannibal Bivouac, which sort of lies kind of like towards between Turin and sort of the Val Thorens-Aurel area. It's on the border between France and Italy. And it's a long ascent. You start very low down, and it's a good almost 2,000 meters, I think, from memory, to get up to it. And it's just quite a tough, brutal climb, and it just went on and on and on. And obviously with this sort of photography element, I'm carrying a lot of heavy photography equipment. Then I've got maybe a small sleeping bag, the food, the gas, the stove. And then actually you need some ski mountaineering equipment, as you said before, sort of ice axe and crampons. So when you fill up that bag, it's, you know, you're talking 20 kilo bag probably. And when we arrived, I went with a friend that time, which was handy. And we arrived in it sort of cloud as it's just getting dark. The clouds just rolling in, and it went to total whiteout for at least half an hour. So we had to do some creative route finding and navigation to get there. But we got there, and obviously when you get your bag off and get cozy and get some food in you, it's pretty special.
Yeah, after you've done the climb. But that sounds pretty impressive. Do you have a favourite of all of the refuges that you've been to?
Yeah, I think the Gavasuti probably stands out for me. I think it's pretty special. I think it's just because it's the contrast of the sort of spacey, incredible architecture. It doesn't feel like a structure that should exist in that environment. And that's, it just stands out, I think.
Yeah, that's true. I'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes. And evidently, if listeners, you know, want to see more of the different refuges we're talking about, they can buy your book as well. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I mean, I suppose you call it like a coffee table book, but there's a lot of commentary and history. You talk about the culture of refuges as well. I wonder, do you have any idea how many refuges you might have visited in your career?
That's a good question. Yeah, I guess at least sort of 60 to 70, maybe more, I suppose, over the years. And yeah, I suppose other worldwide places of different mountaineering missions as well. Although I have to say the book is sort of targeted at a worldwide focus, and we do cover some huts from other mountain ranges, but the Alps just has standout infrastructure for alpine refuges. So I think, yeah, if you're looking for the best huts, then you don't need to go further than the Alps.
Fantastic. And I noted in the intro that you're also the founder of the British Alpine Collective. I wondered if you could just tell us briefly about that. Such a fantastic name.
Yeah, it started off, I guess, when I was just a weekend warrior at the time, trying to spend as much time as I could outdoors, working a full-time job before I started full-time in photography. And it just struck me that most people maybe didn't understand the amazing wild spaces that the UK has to offer. I think there's such a holiday, a strong holiday culture of people wanting to travel abroad in the UK. And I guess we started the British Adventure Collective to kind of remind people that there's some amazing outdoor spaces that they should visit at home before jetting all over the world. And obviously then I moved to the Alps afterwards, but the name lives on.
Oh, well, I'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes as well. Katia, you put your hand up just then. You have a question for Aaron?
Yeah, I was just wanted to ask, you were saying that, you know, more of the refuges are sort of in Europe. Is that just much more sort of European mountaineering culture to have those sort of retreats in the mountains than you would find, say, in the US?
Yeah, I think so. I think the history of alpinism is obviously so strong and, you know, has been going for 200 years plus, I guess, sort of leisure time spent exploring and challenging yourself in the Alps. And I suppose that culture has just resulted in more infrastructure being built over the years. And, you know, I'm sure lots of North Americans would, or Canadians especially, might argue that we've ruined the Alps a little bit with the amount of infrastructure we've built. But it also facilitates, you know, these amazing days that would be probably quite difficult otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't feel to me like the mountains are covering refuges. But, you know, around here, there tends to be one per glacial valley, let's say, which enables things like the Oak Route, for example. Well, that is fantastic, Aaron. I really appreciate you sharing all of that with us. I'm going to put the relevant links in the show notes. Katia, we mentioned the States just now. It seems like the right time to cross the Atlantic. Before we move on to Sundance, Katia, do you have much experience with refuges yourself? Have you stayed in?
I don't. I'm quite new to ski touring and kind of backcountry adventures, despite having skied for a very long time. But I recently went and did a week-long ski touring trip in the Dolomites with Maybe Ski, actually. And that was my kind of first proper experience. I'd only ever done sort of a day here or there before. And we did stay in some refuges, which were very nice because they were really delicious food and nice bedrooms and really quite luxurious. So, so it was a good start, I think, a good entry point.
Yeah, cool. Well, they sound like the same refuges that Catherine stayed in as well. Maybe that will be the start of more of that. I wondered if we could just turn to the States, though, just now. Now, I know you've visited many resorts in North America, most recently on your trip to Colorado. Was this your first time at Sundance?
It was. So I went to Utah in February and I visited sort of Park City, Deer Valley and then Sundance. Yeah, so first time there, it was, I have to say, not the best time to visit Utah. It was like their worst winter in about 30 years. But nevertheless, managed to get skiing in. And Sundance was the final stop on the trip.
I suspect that most listeners will have heard of it, first of all, for the film festival. It's famous for launching indie films to the mainstream. I had a look at which films have come out of it. The list includes Reservoir Dogs, The Blair Witch Project, Get Out, Memento. And evidently, there's a huge link to the film industry thanks to Robert Redford. And I think I'm right in saying it was already like a small ski area before Redford bought it. But I wondered if you could just tell us what his connection with the area was and how that worked.
Yeah, so Sundance is located, it's in Provo Canyon in the sort of Wasatch Range. And I mean, it had been inhabited for sort of a long time by Native Americans, by Ute Indians who had used it as their sort of summer ground. And then Scottish immigrants, the Stewart family, came along and sort of set up a homestead there. And that was kind of the late 1890s. And then sort of mid-1940s, sort of descendants of the Stewart family set up a small, basically a rope tow, and they sort of developed this ski area. They had, I think they had a homemade rope tow, eventually had a sort of apparently rather terrifying T-bar, and it was known as Timp Haven, and it became a sort of local favorite little ski area. And then Robert Redford in sort of early 1960s was kind of touring around on his motorbike and came across this canyon and just sort of fell in love with it. And he was still quite early on in his career there. So he bought it from the Stewarts with a sort of kind of promise that he would kind of preserve it as well. He just built a kind of cabin for himself and his family. And that's kind of where it started.
It sounded like, when you're telling us the history of Sundance there, a bit like Yellowstone compressed. I don't know if you watch your TV series Yellowstone, but a bit like Yellowstone kind of compressed into, 30 seconds of these generations, going through, starting with the original immigrants. But so Robert Redford bought the area. He bought his own cabin there, but you're saying that there weren't many lifts. When did it actually kind of develop into what we would, think of as a ski resort?
His career started to take off and he bought more land and he basically started developing the ski hill. He always wanted to preserve it. And I think that's one of the really great things about Sundance. I mean, I love this resort. It's small. It's really local. It just has such a nice vibe to it. And there's always been this emphasis on conservation. And, apparently when he bought it and he sort of started becoming more famous, you had these sort of New York investors going, right, you should build condos, you should build luxury hotels. And he never wanted to do that. So, 70% of the land is protected. And so you have about, I think it's 540 acres now that's skiable. But there's kind of 3,800 acres in total. And most of it is kind of under conservation, which is really unique. And you look at particularly what a lot of resorts in the States are doing, and they're just kind of developing. And, this is, I just think, such a special place, because at its heart, it's really about protecting this beautiful, beautiful area.
I mean, I actually was reading around a little bit about it, and I saw a quote where Robert Redford said that he always felt it should be developed a little, preserved a lot. And it sounds, from what you're saying there, that that is a focus. And, you are, I think, alluding to other resorts nearby there. We've covered Deer Valley on the podcast before. Now, Deer Valley have like doubled their ski area recently by going into areas which we're saying in terms of Sundance are going to be preserved for the future.
Completely. Yeah. So, Sundance have actually just had, they've just done an expansion. So they have added 170 acres of new skiable terrain. Sadly, it wasn't open when I visited because there just wasn't enough snow and they don't have snowmaking capacity. That's something that Robert Redford had sort of in the blueprint. It is growing a little bit, but still the emphasis is very much on preserving kind of what they have.
Sure. And I had a look at the piece map. It seems that there's a mix. It's not a huge area, but a lot of black runs and a lot of double black diamond options off the top of one of the lifts called Red's Lift. What was the skiing like, taking into account that maybe the whole area wasn't open?
So that area was all shut. So, I really, really arrived at the not a great time. So, I didn't get to ski the whole terrain. It's only got four lifts as it stands anyway. It is not a big resort. But, what I love about skiing in the States is, whilst you have your sort of marked runs, everything kind of is linked, because you can ski through the trees and you can kind of find your way sort of from one side to the other by just kind of navigating some trees. And so, look, I skied as much as I could. I was lapping quite a lot of the same runs because there was not that much open. It was busy, not busy as in lots of people, but it was busy with locals who just have been skiing there for kind of decades. I sort of rode the lift with a couple of brothers in their late 60s, and they learned to ski there and they just love it. And then I rode a lift with kind of these two cousins who were sort of age 16 and 8, and how in the States everybody chats to you on the chairlift. It's so nice, and so you have these really nice conversations. And these two kids were telling me what they love about it and how they like doing tricks. And it's got a really nice local feel to it. Yeah, I think people who live nearby really, really love it.
It's interesting. I don't think that's necessarily unique to the States, chatting on chairlifts, because I talk to everybody I share a chairlift with, because I'm always interested in finding out more about who's come to this area and why they're there, etc. But I think another thing that, we were talking prior to this podcast, something that's a feature of Sundance, and it's related to Robert Redford, his ownership meant it developed as a kind of hub for the arts. And that is definitely something that you notice if you visit.
Totally. So, you know, it was very much preserving this sort of beautiful area, and then obviously his background in film. So the US Utah Film Festival is how Sundance actually originated. So Sundance Film Festival, he didn't actually start the film festival, but he took it over in the early 1980s and really developed it as a place for up-and-coming filmmakers to kind of hone their craft. So in addition to the festival, you've got sort of various labs and workshops and fellowships, and you know, that's still is going on today. And so you have people like Chloe Zhao, who just directed Hamnet, you know, which was up for sort of eight Oscars. You know, she went through there for one of her films. You know, it's really sort of acted as an incubator for a lot of young talent. And actually in one of the lodges at the base, you know, you've got this wonderful hall lined with photos kind of showing kind of the history of Sundance, the history of filmmaking. And you've kind of got all these big names and young faces sort of on display, which is really nice.
But it's not just film, because you did say to me that you explored your creative side elsewhere while you were there, right?
Exactly. So in addition to film, they have sort of an artist studio and kind of makers workshop. And so you have local artists who are there, you know, doing pottery or glass blowing or jewelry making. And as a visitor, you can sign up to do a class. And so I joined a local jewelry maker called Asia. And together, we made a ring. I say she mostly made the ring, and then very kindly sort of said, well done, you've made this beautiful ring. But that was really nice. And I think it's sort of, yeah, it's part of that kind of Sundance spirit and ethos, that it's a, you know, very kind of creative place.
And just to clarify, you know, it's in Utah, so I presume it was a flight to Salt Lake City and then a relatively short transfer from there?
Yeah, it's just an hour, so really easy to get to. And I say it's very small, so you get there and you have the base area, which is kind of a ski shop, the lift tickets, and the new hotel. And that was one of the other reasons I went, because they had this new inn at Sundance Resort that opened just this season. These new owners have kind of invested, and they've done well. I spoke to quite a lot of the locals about their thoughts on sort of the new expansion and the new owners. And, you know, overall, people are pleased with what they've done. There's been a lot of communication. You know, they did things that were really needed, like expanded the parking a bit, improved the sort of base lodge. So I think it looks positive.
Oh, so evidently there are a lot of resorts in Utah that people can ski in. You mentioned a few of the others that you also visited on your trip. Who do you say Sundance is suitable for then?
So it's definitely, it's for people who really like a smaller, I think more independent resort. You know, it was really interesting doing Park City, Deer Valley and Sundance, because they are such different personalities, and obviously each cater to a different type of skier. I'd say if you love skiing, then doing all three, if you can, is amazing. But, you know, the beauty of Sundance is that it's so much more affordable. And if there's good snow, you could absolutely spend a good 5 days exploring that area. You know, the new terrain with the sort of black diamonds, double diamonds, look like there'll be a lot of fun. And then actually from next season, you're going to be able to go across into the back bowl from there. There's going to be a new lift called the Electric Horseman. Nice nod to a Redford film. So that's going to be linking that kind of bottom of that new terrain. So, you know, look, if the snow's good, it would be an amazing place to stay and ski for 5 days, a week or so. And, you know, it's affordable compared to a lot of other American resorts. You know, you can get a lift for $119 a day, which is very cheap compared to some of its neighbours.
For sure. My brother was recently in Breckenridge, and not having bought his lift tickets in advance, was paying $300 a day for a lift pass, which is just insane. Talking of the lift ticket, then, I don't think it is, but you can tell me, is Sundance on any of those collective passes like Epic
fully,
or Icon?
Fully independent.
Okay, well, that's really interesting, Katya. Thank you so much for that. I am hoping to do a trip to Utah at some point in the future. No idea when that will be, but hopefully I'll be able to drop into Sundance as well. Right, we're just going to move towards the close now. Listener, if you've enjoyed this episode, or even if you didn't like it, I would love to know. You can leave a comment on Spotify, Instagram, or Facebook. Our handle is @theskipodcast. You can drop me an email email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of each podcast. Look in the show notes for that link. We have had some feedback since the last episode. Martin Crawshaw, he contacted me about the coverage we've had about train travel. He said to me, I'm currently skiing in Champéry, Switzerland, which can be reached by train direct via funicular from the mainline station at Aigle. So thanks for that tip, Martin, for all the ski flight free travellers out there. Sean Ski is another rail traveller. He said, it's such a great podcast. I look forward to it every week. I've been particularly inspired by your series on the Tyrol. As I write, I'm en route by train to Landeck. Now, that's great, Sean. Love to know which resort you went to. Let us know. Linley Lewis said, I wanted to drop you a line to let you know I greatly enjoyed your Saint Foix episode. Saint Foix has become an annual pilgrimage for my family. It's an absolute gem. And I think you summed up its joy perfectly. Claire said, we've just returned for a week in Fugen in the Zillertal. After listening to episode 272, we love the ski area. Very efficient transport, range of slopes. We'll be back for sure. And Colin Tierney said, I love skiing in Austria. You could do a different resort every winter without having to repeat. Now, there are now 308 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. 187 of those were listened to in the last week, including, I noticed, my previous interviews with Winter Olympians such as Andrew Musgrave, Eddie the Eagle, Dave Riding, Graham Bell, both Izzy and Zoe Atkin, Shemi Alcott, Bodie Miller, and Kirsty Muir. So if you'd like to listen to an interview with an athlete or get an insight on a particular destination or even find out about the latest kit, just go to skipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to listen to. In the last week, people have been listening to podcasts across the planet. The majority of our listeners are in the UK, 23% in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as Malaysia, Finland, and Puerto Rico. If you'd like to help the podcast, there are three things you can do. You can follow us or subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can give us a review on Apple Podcasts, leave a comment on Spotify. And if you're about to go out skiing before the end of the season and haven't booked your ski hire yet, you're in luck because you can save yourself some money by using the code SKIPODCAST when you book at intersportrent.com. And to make that even easier, I'll put a link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied. Right. That is it for today's episode. I will be back in 2 weeks' time when I'll be speaking to the first British woman to join the Verbier Ski Patrol and the man who designed Condé Tovex's new range of skis. So until then, I'd like to thank my guest today. Katia, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on again.
And Aaron, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Great to chat and enjoy Saint-Gervais.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Tyrol for sponsoring the podcast. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.